KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I always loved the saxophone, and I never really had to be asked to practice. I just loved it.
Hey, bro. Hey, bro. Hey, bro.
I can't get it any smoother than that.
What if we did it as a live radio show that's recorded, and then that group of people that sees the live performance, they get a special event. But then it's going to be available for other people all over.
That's Leslie Law, producer and director of Sandbox Radio Live. We're going to hear from her a little later in the hour. A little later in the next hour, we're going to hear from Leslie Hazelton, the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. And in a little bit, about 10 minutes, we're going to hear from Kenny G. His music, why he loves the internet, why he likes to have fun with what people say about his career, and what he says himself about his music. He'll also perform. But we're going to start with the Washington State Liquor Control Board holds a public hearing tonight at Seattle City Hall on how to implement the state's new marijuana law. The first one on Tuesday night in Olympia drew a standing room only crowd eager to weigh in on how Washington would set up a system to license marijuana growers, processors, and sellers. You're listening to Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. John Davis is going to be there. He's owner and CEO of Northwest Patient Resource Center, chairman of the board of directors of Seattle HempFest. He's been working on drug policy in Washington State for more than 20 years. John Davis, thank you for taking the time.
Glad to be here, Steve.
What do you think of the liquor board hearings?
Oh, I think they're great. I think that the liquor board is engaging their communities like they should and giving everyone a fair shot at getting these licenses and getting out the information, not only to those people that are applying for the licenses, but for people that are just interested in what's going on, because this has never happened before.
Is there anything missing from those hearings at this point?
Well, there's a lot of unanswered questions out there. The first and foremost is, where is the supply of legal marijuana going to come from? This has been a clandestine industry for many years, and a few of us have been working to bring out the legitimacy of the market, but we haven't exactly been helped along the way. And the upshot of that is that most producers that are out there that are operating today are not operating in any way that can be licensable. And because of that, the supply of cannabis is, from a legal and permitted standpoint, is very, very rare. And there's a lot of infrastructure that has to be put in place if this is going to be a successful program. The retail outlets, as they spring up, are going to have something to sell. And frankly, it's going to be challenging.
Now, you do have, at this point in our state, legal outlets for medical marijuana. I would assume that the people who are legally growing medical marijuana will be first in line to help set up the infrastructure for retail marijuana.
Yeah, and, luckily there's some of us that have some expertise, but that expertise is still rare in our state. And as I say, we've been working to get people into properly zoned facilities and even permitted facilities, but permitting a cannabis grow in Washington State has not exactly been easy, and therefore the amount of facilities out there that can be considered permitted is less than a dozen.
Less than a dozen at this point?
Yes.
You also, I've heard you talk about how they're also too often in houses, and we need to get them into commercial areas.
Exactly. I mean, I don't believe, and in my talking with the Liquor Control Board, I don't believe that a license for a producer is going to be a license that's very hard to get, because the Liquor Control Board realizes that there needs to be the supply. But getting the permit is step one. That's the easy step. Step two is getting a permit, and there are very few localities in Washington State where you can do the simple change of use to change to get a building permit to grow cannabis. And so even if you have your license, are they going to permit the places that are in residences right now to be legal producers of cannabis? They're not zoned properly. They're improperly placed. They're likely to be problematic. They're in communities where people have, you know, their lives, their houses, their kids. Being a producer in an area that's still semi-black market, you know, it's cannabis can be as good as cash, and that can open up security issues. You know, are these places going to cause robberies and all this stuff? Therefore, being in a residence, a residential area, is a really bad idea.
So,
and really, legally, most of the people out there are not operating in a legal fashion.
So, John Davis, somebody who's been working on this for a long time, a couple other points on that. One is the concern that the feds have expressed and other states have expressed, how are you going to keep legal Washington state marijuana going into Idaho, Montana, Oregon, or beyond? What's your thoughts about security?
Well, as far as diversion to other states, in the meeting with Holder and Inslee and Ferguson, that was one of the things that came up, was diversion. And that is something that is appropriate for the federal government to worry about. But is diversion going to happen? I don't really think that that's our big problem here. One, anyone that's a licensed producer, I'm sure through rulemaking, is going to have to show where, you know, how much they produce and where it went to.
Well, how clear do you think the link is between what the Liquor Control Board did with liquor for all these years and what it could possibly do with regulating the sale of marijuana?
Well, I think they're good at, the Liquor Control Board is clearly good at implementing rules, you know, and, you know, in doing enforcement. Yeah, that's their strong suit. But they don't, what they don't know is they don't know cannabis. They don't know the cannabis industry. And it's an industry that has to actually be born fairly quickly.
Have you been contacted by them as somebody who's been an expert in this and been involved in the industry? Have you come in to talk to Liquor Control Board people?
Oh, sure. They call me. We've done several presentations for them to let them know exactly how it works. They're interested in processing, how that takes place. You know, what's used. How does that stay safe?
I was interested in the comments people made about environmental issues. One thing that we could see is better control of what gets, and knowledge of what gets put onto marijuana and how it's then dumped back into sewer systems or whatever. Is that an issue, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And it goes back to permitting. And this is kind of the real bugaboo that we're seeing, is the people that are out there that are operating now are not operating in a legal, environmentally safe, and following simple things like energy code. When we get better regulation, and as these facilities spring up, absolutely we're going to have environmental concerns, and that's appropriate. But those places have to be built. They don't really exist right now.
So for you, the first step is really to hammer out the permitting by which a person could become engaged in this business at the grow level.
Yeah, and as I say, these facilities have to be built, and it's things like banks. Banks won't work with people that work in the cannabis industry, and these places, in order to be real businesses, have got to operate legally with bank accounts so that they can pay their taxes, etc. Also, the localities, most localities do not have a use that supports indoor cultivation of anything. So where Seattle has been more progressive and put in place zoning regulations and use that you can actually, come in and say, look, this is what I'm going to do. I'm making a facility to grow cannabis, and this is the way that I'm going to do it, so that the building officials can say, yeah, okay, we need you to do this to follow energy code. We need you to do this so that you're legally zoned.
Very interesting. John Davis, I appreciate you taking the time. I know you'll be there tonight to lay some of these ideas out. Thanks
Absolutely.
A lot.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
John Davis is owner and CEO of Northwest Patient Resource Center, chairman of the board of Seattle HempFest. He also chairs the Coalition for Cannabis Standards and Ethics, the state's largest cannabis industry association. The birth pains of a new industry. The Washington State Liquor Control Board hearing starts at Seattle's City Hall at 6 p.m. tonight.
Born in Seattle, grew up in Seattle, and with his saxophone became one of the top-selling American musical artists of all time. Kenny G is our guest next. Forty-four degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says expect clouds through the day with an afternoon high of 46. Overnight, it'll be rainy with a low of 40. And tomorrow, Friday, rain at times with a high of 47.
Hello again, I'm Warren Alney. Next time on To The Point, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is lifting the ban on women in combat, opening thousands of frontline positions to female soldiers as soon as this May. How will the historic decision affect military culture? Will we still fight wars in the same way? That's next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That's this morning at 11 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and its evening and weekend MBA program, offering a Saturday option for full-time working professionals from outside the Bay Area to earn a Berkeley MBA. Seattle information session on January 30th. More information at haas.berkeley.edu.
It's 9:17. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Sandbox Radio is a group of folks here in Seattle that puts together plays, poetry, and music for radio, then performs and records a live show. KUOW's Marcy Silliman has more on that just about a half an hour from now.
Yeah, Kenny G still remembers that song and rocking to it, huh?
Gosh, that was a long time ago. By the way, that was not me singing, people.
That wasn't you singing?
No, I haven't shrieked that high since I was about 15.
I like that. Somebody's going to burn you cold, bold, and together. A funk band from the 70s. Kenny G, sax man, best-selling instrumentalist. Graduated from Franklin High School. You did graduate, didn't you?
I did, and I also graduated from the University of Washington. I can feel myself being pulled back to one of the dorms as we're so close to the UW.
What'd you get a degree in?
Accounting.
Of course.
Yeah.
That makes...
Phi Beta Kappa, too. I had straight A's until about, I think, in the middle of my junior year, I got like a 3.7 in one class. It was still an A, but I didn't have my 4.0.
It's because you were out playing music at night?
That's right. I was down in downtown at this club called the Golden Crown Up, which is on right across the street from what used to be the Bon Marché.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Is the Bon Marché still there?
No.
No.
Macy's.
That's Macy's. It was across the street.
And so is that where the... Well, on what street? On 4th?
On 4th. It was...
So the building's still there somewhere.
Building's still there. Sherman Clay Pianos was there and downstairs, and then... The Chinese restaurant was upstairs called the Golden Crown, and they call it the Golden Crown Up because we had to go upstairs.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Following stints with Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra at the age of 17, the Jeff Lorber Fusion, and Cold Bolden together. He he embarked on a solo career in the 80s. 1992 album Breathless, best-selling instrumental album of all time. His 1994 album Miracles, best-selling Christmas album of all time. He's collaborated with many musical legends, Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, Katy Perry. I don't know if we can call her a musical legend yet, but you were with Katy Perry.
She's pretty.
Yeah. Saturday Night Live. Didn't you get on the Saturday Night Live when they were they had your character and you came on one time too?
Well, not with the character. I came on to play with a band called Foster.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But you wanted. That's right. I saw that.
I asked them. I saw the guy that did me, and I said, "Hey, bro, I'm right here. Let me do it." Oh yeah, we should do that. And then it didn't happen. But that would be fun. I should have come out there and done my own caricature.
You do not mind that.
No, it's funny.
It is funny.
I like funny. If it's not funny, I don't like it. If it's mean then, and it's not funny, it's not funny.
Yeah.
But if it's funny, I'm cool.
But you like that South Park one. The South Park.
Yes. It's funny. It's really funny. I play the note that makes the whole world crap, you know? It's funny.
It's funny you said that about accounting. I found this. I like this quote here. Jeff Lorber, one of G's first employers, is blunt about whether he had any inkling of the man's future stardom. Absolutely none, but a lot of other players just weren't all that interested in working hard and doing what has to be done to make it in the music business. When I met Kenny, it was very different. He immediately understood that things could go somewhere. He had a fantastic attitude about wanting to jump in and get with the program.
Hmm.
Did you feel that way when you were in your 20s?
I still feel that way. I still need to jump on and work hard. I practice every day 3 hours on this thing and still feel like I've got so much, so far to go and so many things to do.
Kenny G's at Jazz Alley for the next few days through Sunday, 7:30 and 9:30 the shows. That instrument you're holding, that looks like a well-worn instrument, and it is.
Yeah, it's my high school saxophone.
I just think that's so cool. Is it do you have others? You have many others?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I've got a few others, but I never play them.
Is that right?
They're backups that have never been used. I mean, sure, I'll practice them every now and then, but I've never had to use them at a gig.
Where did you get that? How did they come to you?
An ad in the paper when I was at Franklin High School. I was 17. I put an ad in the paper, said, wanted soprano sax. And this guy from Lacey, Washington, answered the ad, said, I've got one. I brought it over from France when I was in the service. And it's $300. I said, I'll drive down. I drove down and it was in a green case. It was a lot shinier than it is now. And I just bought it.
How'd you know you wanted to be playing the soprano sax?
Grover Washington Jr. was my idol in high school. At Franklin High, we listened to Grover Washington Jr., Tower of Power, Barry White. And I heard Grover's sound and I thought, that doesn't even sound like a saxophone. I want to sound like that. So I tried so hard to be the white Grover Washington Jr. And I failed miserably. I only had my own sound, which obviously turned out to be a good thing. So with failing that, it gave me the opportunity to have my own sound.
All right. You were nice enough to come in and play with us. So let's hear some of your own sound. And then I'm going to ask you about, I want to ask you about the scene in the 70s that brought you to Cold Bolden together. But
cool.
Tell me about this song.
This is a song called Loving You. It's was written by myself and my longtime writing partner named Walter Afanasieff, who has, if you're in the world of music, he's famous. He's won Grammys. He's produced Mariah Carey's hits, Celine Dion's hits, did a lot for Michael Bolton. He's amazing guy. He's really, really amazing. He's done over like $1 billion worth of songs that have sold. Obviously, that's not his money, but he's been my friend for like 30 years, and we write songs together. This is one of our songs. And it's good because it's like a waltz. It's in 3-4, and it's a little different.
By the way, you said in terms of your sound. So we're going to hear over a track.
Yes.
But describe what you have attached to that saxophone.
It's just a wireless microphone, so I can kind of walk around. I mean, you got a big room here, so
yeah.
I'll probably just kind of, putter like I did. Like if I'm practicing at home, I'll just putter
enough. You got enough headphone space.
I got enough headphones. So basically what people are going to hear is the track is already recorded. So this is not lip syncing, folks. I'm really playing. I'm not at the steps of the White House.
What did you think of that, by the way?
Well, look, I've actually been there and done that for Clinton. And it is so cold there. You can't understand when that Marine band that's playing, like the Army band, Marine band, the guys are touching instruments that metal is freezing cold. So to play in tune, the one they did with Kelly Clarkson was amazing. because I know they all played live, and she sounded awesome. So that was really
Was she live as well?
She seemed live to me.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's any way you could do all the things she did. And, I mean, I watched her, you know, closely. I always watched that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And she looked perfect. And the Marine Band was amazing because I was thinking, how are those guys playing in tune? It's too cold. I mean, literally, when you want to tune a saxophone, see the mouthpiece here, you have to push it in. You got only so much room. And you can't push it in far enough to make it not flat in that cold environment. So they, for some reason, they managed to do it. I don't know about the Beyonce thing. And obviously, the band wasn't playing live. Now, was she singing? I didn't really pay that much attention.
Wait, when you were there with Clinton, you were playing live?
I'm playing live, yeah.
So you know how it's...
I know, I know, because I was flat. Hey, but it was live. You know, there's only so much you can do. You can't, you know, physically... I couldn't take a hacksaw and cut the saxophone down and make it shorter.
That's quite an honor to be playing there with Clinton.
It was amazing. I'm telling you, that experience was so fun. We did a bunch of things. We played one of the balls, played there. And, you know, it was so cool because... I don't know why, but there were Secret Service assigned to me. And wherever I went, they were walking and making sure I was cool. They had open doors. We went to the FBI building. They said, hey, you want to shoot some of the guns here? I said, yeah, sure.
And so, you did?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really good. I shot one of those Tommy guns. They're not easy to shoot.
What do you mean, from the 30s with the big round magazine?
Yeah, with the big round thing. You want to shoot one? I said, yeah, sure, let me try. And it was fun. I had a really good time. It's like getting a backstage pass to Washington, D.C.
Did you have to dress up when you went to the inaugural balls? Do you have a tuxedo and everything?
I think I just wore a suit. I'm a guy, you know, but people don't pay much attention to what guys wear. You know, it's a suit and a tie, a suit and a bow tie. Whether it's a tux or not, I can't even tell the difference.
Well, that's a tux. Yeah. Longer tails.
Longer tails.
All right, please.
Here we go. Thank you.
Loving you.
That was cool.
That was cool. Phi Beta Kappa UW accounting graduate Kenny G in the Studio B, wandering a bit.
Yep.
Playing to the crowd.
You know, there's people out there watching, but there's one guy like standing way in the corner where he can't even see me. All he had to do was move over in the middle. He could have seen me. Sorry about
you were
that.
Having a little fun there with the instrument.
It sounds, you know, it sounds so good in the headphones. So my sound man, Monty's here. And it's a pleasure, you know, just to...
Monty was saying that you and Monty have been working together since the first album, right?
Yep, like 27 years. He's given me 27 years.
You guys found a way you liked miking that horn, and you've stuck with it.
Yeah, there's a certain sound. He EQs it a certain way, reverb, as you could tell. So it blends in there. It sounded like you just turned the CD on. You realize I was really playing. It was
That's what I mean. You're having a little fun with the riffs. You're having a little fun playing with yourself.
I always have fun playing with myself.
Thank you. I'm glad I set you up for that.
Thank you. That's easy.
All right. Leave us to address the critics for a moment.
Sure. Why not?
And the dismissive tone that you get from critics about this music and your music. And I did note in one of your interviews that you said, look, there are people who are second and third rate. They shouldn't be on the radio.
I agree. And that's what the critics are probably saying about me.
but you that doesn't bother you.
No, because I know I'm not. You know, I mean, I can hear, I can take myself out of myself and listen. I can hear my tone. I can hear my technique. I can hear how I play. And there's a difference between, you know, when I said there's some people that shouldn't be on the radio, there's a difference. I'm sorry to say. And no, that's no ego. I'm just, I know how much I practice and I know what it takes to play in tune, right kind of tone, technique, timing, all that stuff. So when the critics say that, really they're just coming from a standpoint that they don't like this kind of music.
Right. They're dismissing the kind of music.
Yeah.
What do you call this kind of music?
I call it my kind of music.
Do you avoid labels?
Yeah, because smooth jazz sounds so generic these days. But most people would think of it. Look, a lot of people just think that what I play is jazz. They call it jazz. And, of course, the jazz traditionalists would go, oh, my God, please don't say those words about his music. But jazz is jazz. I've opened up many a show for Miles Davis. So I was on the road with Miles Davis for 6 months to 8 months, right? So I saw him all the time. And Miles turned his back on the audience, and he played stuff that had nothing to do with his bebop origins. And people went, oh, my God, that's so amazing. They listen to that jazz. And, you know, he would say that my music was jazz because it was just me playing what I'm playing.
Do you feel you veer from your smooth jazz origins in your recordings?
I don't think I have smooth jazz origins. I think I have R&B origins.
Okay.
From going to Franklin.
Do you think that you, like Miles Davis, are you playing the spectrum of sounds of what we're calling jazz? Let's call it music.
Yeah, let's call it music. I think I'm just kind of doing what feels right at the time and just trying to be different each time, every time I do a record, trying to come up with new songs and things like that.
By the way, you traveled with Miles Davis all those years?
All those years.
What was that like?
Fun. Really fun.
What kind of man was he? As a musician, as a mentor?
He didn't talk to me much. He didn't talk to anybody much. He didn't say much to anybody. I did learn a big lesson from playing with him one night. We played at Lincoln Center and two shows that night. So I'm obviously his opening act. So I open the first show, play. He comes in my dressing room and goes, man, that was great. You were great. I'm going to open for you the second show. I said, oh, my God. I'm thinking to myself, Miles is going to open up for me? Yeah. You know what? I've made it. Yeah. Oh, Miles, you opened up for me. Fine. So he does his thing. Now, by the time I get on stage, it's midnight. And there was about, out of 3,000 people, there was about 100 left. They all came to see Miles. And I'm thinking, that guy knew what he was doing. He just did not want to stay there late.
He just wanted to go home and go to sleep.
Home. So I said, you know, I'm going to learn that lesson. That was a good lesson to learn. And you know what? And I deserve it. I'm an opening act. That's what happens. You learn those, pay those dues, and then you get your chance later. But I never did that to anybody.
That's very funny. All right. I have a ton of questions, but I got to get one more song in.
Oh.
So look at how fast the half an hour goes.
Man.
Saxo Loco, what's that about?
This is a fast song. This is, you know, I'm telling you, writing up-tempo, snappy, jazzy, cool, well, I don't know, cool, but fun instrumentals, that's the hardest thing of all. Ballads are easy, you know, because it's tone, it's, you know, it's emotion. But you write a fast song, it either sounds really stupid or it works. And I'm going to say this one works. This is... My friend Walter and I wrote this song. It's all about a Latin record. We did a Latin record together called Rhythm and Romance. two white guys, me and Walter, got together with all the Latino guys in L.A., all the guys, you know, John Pena, we had, who else do we have? Sanchez was playing percussion, and we had Alex Acuna on drums. So we had all the guys, all the Latino guys. So we get into the studio and said, look, we have this music, guys, but you have to make it sound Latin. So they did. And this is one song called Saxoloco. It's up-tempo. Hope it doesn't sound too corny.
Sound great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sexo Loco, Kenny G, and a whole room full of musicians through the magic of recording.
There you go.
You know, I have to say that was cool to hear it with the headphones on, but I wish some folks could also have heard it just you playing,
yeah,
because you really do hear all the work you're doing.
Thanks.
And just the sound of the saxophone and
yeah,
how much fun you're playing.
So there you go.
Kenny G is performing at Seattle's Jazz Alley tonight through Sunday. Shows are 7:30 and 9:30. Music being produced by his sound man,
Monty Montfort. Yeah.
Monty Montfort and Doug Patterson. Sounded great.
Yeah,
you,
Doug.
You guys, so Grammy Award winner, best-selling Christmas album of all time, Miracles, 1992 Breathless, best-selling instrumental album of all time, and the holder of the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest sustained saxophone note.
I know, isn't that crazy?
You and Dizzy Gillespie were in a contest? What was
that? He had the cheeks for it. Well, you saw me on that last tune when I was playing those real fast riffs,
yeah,
and they would just keep going. I was circular breathing that so I could keep it going, so... Yeah, I'm breathing in and playing at the same time.
And you decided one day, you know, I could do this for 45 minutes and get the world's record? How'd that come about?
Well, let's see. How did I decide to do that? I was doing the Regis show when Regis was on, and I was sitting in the green room with the guy from the Guinness Records that comes on and talks about these, you know, it's just TV stuff. You know, this guy rode his bicycle for whatever, you know, whatever. So he's got all these things, and on the show, Regis had asked me, hey, show us how you do that breathing thing. So I gave him a demo, you know, with breathing in the nose and the whole thing, and of course they make jokes about it. It's a funny thing. And the Guinness guy goes, hey, why don't you set a world record? I said, well, what is the world record? He said, there isn't any. I said, well, cool. That means I'm probably going to set the world record. And I figured maybe if I went 10 minutes. And so I just I practiced at home and tried it. And I went like 10 or 11 minutes at home. I thought, okay, I'll just go and see what happens. And in the course of doing it, I just kept going and kept going. And finally, at 45 minutes and 47 seconds, a piece of spit got in the reed and it stopped the sound.
Oh,
just
no
for a
kidding.
Split second. And then I kept going. But I didn't actually do anything. But the Guinness guy goes, oh, that's it. That's it. You're done.
You're doing it in front of a big hall of judges?
I did it in front of a couple of Guinness judges and about 300 people in a record store that came to watch. And I'm thinking, these guys, this is going to be the most boring concert they've ever seen because this guy holding one note. I said, please, don't watch me. Go do something else. Come back. I'll still be here. Anyway, that was really cool. So did that. Iced my lips afterwards because I was really tired. That hurt.
I
really
hurt.
Yeah.
Circular breathing is not that easy anyways.
Yeah, it's easy for me now. But, I mean, you know, doing it 10 minutes is no big deal. But 45 minutes, it really starts to... And then the thing is they wouldn't let me... Like, I wanted to hold a certain note. So now my fingers are on the saxophone and they can't move. So I said, can I just tape the notes down so I don't have to hold the...
Yeah, no way.
Can I do... No. You can't play loud. You can't play soft. It has to be. I mean, they've got these meters out watching your volume, everything. So they got all these parameters. And if you stay within the parameters, then you're cool. Once you're out of the parameters, I said, hey, can I circular breathe and not just hold one note? Move? No, it's got to be one note. So I had to choose my note. That took a long time.
What did you choose?
E flat. It seemed to work because some notes are a little harder, some notes are a little easier. This one had its advantages and disadvantages. So, but listen, that's technical stuff. It was fun, though. It was fun. And I'm going to go an hour before I retire.
Which really?
I'm going to do that.
Just to like sort of make sure nobody can get up behind you.
And also, I want to use it as a promotional plug of some sort. So, I mean, that's these days, it's hard to get, you know, like getting on Regis or getting on, not Regis, what is it now? Michael and Kelly? Kelly and Michael? You know, the show, it's not easy. Those days are over.
Because there's so many celebrities?
Because there's just, I don't really know what it is. I've always had a tough time on TV because most people, the feedback is, you know, nobody really wants to watch you play that sax for more than 2 minutes. So whatever you're playing, make sure it's 2 minutes or shorter. I said, yeah, but people seem to like my music. Doesn't matter. It's TV. It's not going to work.
It's TV, man.
And they always say that. So it's always been a little tough to get on TV with this thing, but... I you know, that's what I do, so I do that.
Hey, you said earlier when I said about influences, you said your influences started with Seattle R&B sound.
Yeah.
What were your parents? Who were your parents? What did they do? Were they musicians?
No. My dad was plumber, He started as a plumber, and then he had a plumbing wholesale business. Still does. My dad's still alive, still here in Seattle. He's 91, folks, and he has a company called Thrifty Supply Company. Still here, and he has a big warehouse, which toilets come in there, hot water tanks, pipes, air conditioning stuff, and he's a wholesaler. So he makes 5%, and he's made 5% for about 70 years. So he's done well, you know.
Well, how did music come into your life?
My mom wanted us to take piano lessons, so I started when I was 6 and took piano lessons in the Seward Park area. Went over to this lady's house, and I didn't like her. She was kind of mean. I don't know. Maybe I just felt that she was mean. Maybe she wasn't mean. I shouldn't say that, but I didn't like it, so I quit. My brother liked his piano lessons. He kept playing, but I quit, and after a couple of years of not playing an instrument, I saw someone on TV playing sax on the Ed Sullivan Show, yeah. And I said, you know, Mom, let me try that one.
But it was in you.
It was in me. I was intrigued with the saxophone when I first got it. And it's funny because even now looking at the saxophone, I'm always intrigued on how everything works. And every day when I practice, I'm always like, this is really a cool instrument. I'll press this key down and press this key down and get these different sounds. And if you look at my saxophone, it's, if you look at it really carefully, I'm holding it up so Steve can see it. It's a little bowed. If you can see that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I don't know why. It just came that way. It must have gotten banged up when the guy brought it back from Paris or wherever. And maybe that's part of the magic of this horn. It's got something. I mean, I've played other soprano saxophones. In fact, the serial number on this one is 86,000 something. Something 12. Anyway, I found one that was two serial numbers off. Played it. It's got to be the same sound. It wasn't even the same.
All right, Mr. G, I really appreciate you coming in to talk to me. By the way, do you go by Mr. G all the time?
If you call me that, I'll go. You can call me, that works, yeah. Thanks.
How do you say your last name?
Gorlick.
Gorlick.
Yeah.
Do you use that in your official, you know, your accounting work?
I do it on it's on my passport. Yeah, no, that's the real deal, yeah, of course. But I enjoyed playing. This is a really fun studio to play in. I guess you don't do music very often
here? You know, we try. We don't do it enough. But
no.
Perhaps you will. But with you having come in, perhaps we will encourage others to come in. We had the folks from Wheatles Groove here a year and a half or 2 years.
Did they perform?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was great.
Did they have the whole band set up?
The whole band set up.
Yeah.
It was very cool.
You know what?
You've
got room to it, but that would be a tough miking situation to do live, you know, I think.
Doug Patterson, John Sullivan, Eamon Nordquist, they made it happen. Drums and the whole shebang.
It's the A-team right here, folks.
All right, Kenny G performs at Seattle's Jazz Alley tonight through Sunday. Shows 7:30 and 9:30. He also will help you with your accounting if you want.
And also come down. We're gonna have fun. I'm signing CDs. You can, you know, it's very casual. So don't be afraid. You can come and say hi. We'll be there. Oh, and we're selling saxophones. That's right. My Simon wants us to know we're selling saxophones. So come and get a saxophone.
All right, like those?
Well, not this one, but yeah I designed my own saxophone. They're designed just like this one, but they're brand new. They sound
cool.
Beautiful.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Weekday.
In 9:49. In a minute here, Marcy Silman is going to tell us about a group of folks here in Seattle that puts together plays, poetry, and music for radio, then performs and records a live show. It's called Sandbox Radio. We'll get to that in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
Incoming, a short story about drones.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself. Pity. A signature strike leveled the florists.
Author Teju Cole tweets to humanize the victims of drone attacks.
How could someone like Mrs. Dalloway be brutally killed off by a bomb?
A Twitter strike on drones, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest Public Media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
Kenny G, Marcy, played with Miles Davis.
I was awed by the stories. Love hearing those
there
stories.
There must have been so many more.
Yep.
Maybe he'll come back.
Maybe.
Tell stories.
Listening to us, Kenny.
Yeah, come back.
We invite you back.
All right, Art of Our City. There's a little Art of Our City. Here's more Art of Our City.
Yeah.
Actor Leslie Law.
Yeah, you maybe have seen her if you've ever been to a Christmas Carol at ACT Theater. She is often playing characters like Mrs. Fezziwig, among others. Long, long time staple of Seattle stages, 20 years or so acting on, as she says, every big theater in town except Intimon. Not yet Intimon, but perhaps in the future. But, you know, like a lot of artists, you hit mid-career and you're wanting a little more control over what you do. And so Leslie decided to get together a bunch of fellow mid-career theater artists, writers, musicians, and a lot of actors who you have probably seen or heard. And they created something called Sandbox Radio Live, which is original stuff. And so I brought her in to the radio station, how appropriate, to talk about the origins of the project.
It's a quarterly live performance that's recorded in front of that live audience and turned into a podcast now. Maybe future dream would be it would be broadcast for people to hear. But the live performance event is also very important. And it's all new plays, poems, original music and underscoring, live sound effects.
Everything done by Seattle artists?
Everything done by Seattle artists and primarily members of a group I'm connected with called the Sandbox Artists Collective, which started about in 2008. It was a project out of Freehold, and it's all, we joke that we are mid-career. We're all professional artists here in Seattle. We have lots of stuff going on, which is why our show is on Mondays, actually, because it's the dark day for most of us who are working.
Well, I was
going to
say, mid-career, if people went to the website and sort of just scrolled through the artists, if you go to theater in this town, you would recognize a lot of people's names, either the writers or the performers. So why did you feel a need to start your own production group?
Well, you know, it's interesting. People say, why a radio show? Because I'm primarily a theater artist.
Right.
I don't necessarily even do television or film myself. A lot of my actors in the show do. But I was trying to come up with a way to get all of these unbelievable collaborative artists, the writers especially. We have wonderful playwrights who write for the show, who are part of the collective, these actors, musicians, etc., together to do something, create something new, A, and B, to be able to afford to produce it. Now, if you produce a full run in a theater, that's a lot of money. And you still don't end up reaching that many people. There are only so many people who come to the live performance, right? So I thought, wow, what if it was on the radio? I've always loved radio anyway, so that was feeding right into my sweet spot. What if we did it as a live radio show that's recorded, and then that group of people that sees the live performance, they get a special event, but then it's going to be available for other people all over for whoever knows how long to listen to.
So essentially I don't want to say scale it down because I work in radio, and that seems demeaning to radio, but because you are not putting a full-blown theatrical production up, no costumes, no scenery.
Right.
You've got words, actors, and sound.
Yeah. It's a whole different way of thinking, especially for the writers.
Sure.
And they've just jumped on board with all guns blazing. It's been fantastic to watch them work in the media. Most of them are playwrights who write for the theater. So it's thinking in a whole new way. I wouldn't say it's necessarily scaling it down as far as the creative process, because we rehearse very carefully, prepare these pieces just like we're producing a play for stage. And like I said, Jose Gonzalez, my music director, is in charge of the music, original music. Some of these plays get theme music, like a film, you know, and all the live sound effects, which are scored by us as a sound design team. I call them my sound effects cadre. A few of my actors who meet and we do a design meeting and design, how do we make that sound? And
so, but essentially, it's the visual production values that you don't have to worry about.
We don't. The live performance, if you do come to the live performance, which is, we try to make a really special event. It's a small venue. We're at West of Lennon in Fremont, which is, it's very intimate and wonderful. It's like being in a private recording studio in somebody's house. And if you come to the live show, you get this feeling of, like I said, that intimacy, that being in that sort of exclusive sort of club feel. But we try to keep the lights low because we don't really want people to focus on the visual. We want them to be focusing on what they're listening to.
Why We Run, a poem by Scott Augustson. Consider the gazelle, or more to the point, the gazelle's leg. A beautiful machine of strong bones, ropey muscles, persnickety nerves from its sturdy hooves to its sexy haunches. It has spent millions of years doing nothing but evolving a superhuman ability to outrun lions. No, that's not really right, is it? It doesn't need to outrun lions. It needs to outrun other gazelles. The herd has not been reading Karl Marx. The herd has been reading Shirley Jackson. It's the grazers, the cud chewers, the vegetarians. They're the real cutthroats, aren't they? As we flee our way through life, keeping as much distance as we can between us and, well, whatever the heck it is back there, even a glance over the shoulder seems reckless. On a good day, you can't even feel the hot breath on the back of your neck. Sure, sure, the day will come when we are eaten by sheer attrition or silly mistake or just the inevitable tick of the clock. Eaten.
For stage actors who are used to not only using voices to convey things, but bodies, faces, mm-hmm. expressions, movement around the stage, yeah. how much adaptation did it take to stand still at the microphone and create all the sense of drama that they do when we get to see them moving?
Oh, you know, we're still working on that. After a few episodes, this is, like I said, this is episode 7. So after a few episodes, we learn every single time, of course, what to do better. Just the last episode, one of my collaborators, she and I were talking about how we constantly have to remind ourselves that the live performance is still very exciting and vibrant, and there's a lot to watch, especially the sound effects. But to remind the actors that everything has to go through the microphone, everything has to come through the voice. It's just a different way of thinking. It's very, very exciting for everybody, though.
To flip it around, there are things that the actors have to learn. What do they get from actors and playwrights, mm-hmm. all the artists? What do you get from working in this medium as opposed to your normal one?
For the actors, it's the variety that they get to do in each show. Each actor, it's more like a company, an ensemble of performers. They're all doing multiple characters, different styles, performing sound effects as well. A lot of the actors also are musicians or singers, so they'll get pulled into a music moment.
For this particular project, you're in charge. This is, you are producer, director.
I am, and we joke that I'm the feeds into all of my control.
Well, I'm
issues. If they are issues of my actors and writers out there,
well,
I love you.
I mean, actors don't always, stage actors, TV actors, probably any actors, you're not always in charge of your fate in your normal life.
But you know what's interesting, and you and I have discussed this before, the sort of emergence of these artist-driven projects, mm-hmm. especially in the Northwest lately. I don't think that it's all of a sudden there are a bunch of actors and directors who can produce. I think we all just sort of have come... We're just bursting with the ideas and we just can't help ourselves. That's what happened with me is I had these things that I wanted to do and I just said, why not? I called a group of people, the writers and actors and people I wanted to work with to a meeting one night a couple years ago. And I said, I have this idea and why don't we just do it?
Leslie Law talked with Marcy Silman for a segment we call The Art of Our City. The next Sandbox Radio Live performance, Monday, January 28th, 8 p.m., west of Lennon in Fremont. Doors open at 7:30, featuring our own Elizabeth Austin. You can find out more at kuow.org.
The Navy says it's going to begin giving random blood alcohol tests to its sailors starting next month. More on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.